is a force to be reckoned with.
She is, Brianna admitted, and if it was Hilda or Inga, I'd say it was no contest. But Senga's got her mother's personality. Nobody's telling her what to do, not even Frau Uta.
Where did they get Senga anyway? She added.
There are lots of Ingas and Hildas over toward Salem, but I've never heard of another Senga.
Aye, well, you wouldn't. Not in Salem. It's not a German name, Ken. It's Scots.
Scots? She said in astonishment.
Oh, aye, he said, the grin evident in his voice. It's Agnes, spelt backward. A girl named that is bound to be contrary, don't you think?
You're kidding. Agnes, spelt backward?
I wouldn't say it's common, exactly. But I've certainly met one or two Sangas in Scotland.
She laughed. Do the Scots do that with other names?
Backspelling?
He considered.
Well, I did go to school with a lass named Adnil, and there was a grocer's lad who got in the messages for old ladies in the neighbourhood. His name's pronounced Kiri, but it's spelled C-I-R-E.
She looked sharply at him in case he was teasing, but he wasn't. She shook her head. I think Mama's right about Scots. So yours spelled backward would be?
Rhaegar, he confirmed. Sounds like something from a Godzilla film, doesn't it? A giant eel, maybe, or a beetle with death ray eyes.
He sounded pleased at the notion. You thought about it, didn't you? She said, laughing.
Which would you rather be?
Well, when I was a kid, I thought the beetle with the death ray eyes would be best, he admitted. Then I went to sea and started hauling up the occasional moray eel in my net. Those are not the kind of thing you'd want to meet in a dark alley, believe me.
More agile than Godzilla, at least, she said, shuddering slightly at the recollection of the one moray eel she'd met personally. A 4-foot length of spring steel and rubber, fast as lightning and equipped with a mouthful of razors, it had come up from the hold of a fishing boat she'd watched being unloaded in a little port town called Macduff. She and Roger had been leaning on a low rock wall, idly watching the gulls hover in the wind, when a shout of alarm from the fishing boat just below had made them look down in time to see fishermen scrambling back from something on deck. A dark sine wave had flashed through the silver wash of fish on deck, shot under the rail, and landed on the wet stones of the quay, where it had caused similar panic among the fishermen hosing down their gear, writhing and lashing about like a crazed high-tension cable, until one rubber-booted man, gathering his self-possession, had rushed up and kicked it back into the water.
"Well, there's no really bad sorts, eels," Roger said judiciously, evidently recalling the same memory. "You can't blame them, after all, being dragged up from the bottom of the sea without warning. Anyone would thrash about a bit."
"So they would," she said, thinking of themselves. She took his hand, threading her fingers between his, and found his firm, cold grip a comfort. They were close enough now to catch snatches of laughter and talk, billowing up into the cold night with the smoke of the fire. There were children running loose. She saw two small forms dart through the legs of the crowd around the fire, black and thin-limbed as Halloween goblins.
That wasn't Jem, surely?
No, he was smaller. And surely Lizzie wouldn't...
Midge, Roger said.
What?
Jem, backward, he explained. I was just thinking it would be a lot of fun to see Godzilla films with him. Maybe he'd like to be the beetle with death ray eyes. Be fun, aye?
He sounded so wistful that a lump came to her throat, and she squeezed his hand hard, then swallowed.
"Tell him Godzilla stories," she said firmly. "It's make-believe anyway. I'll draw him pictures."
He laughed at that.
"Christ, you do, and they'll be stoning you for trafficking with the devil, Bree. Godzilla looks like something straight out of the Book of Revelations. Or So I was told.
Who told you that?
Iger.
Who?
Oh, she said, going into mental reverse.
Reggie? Who's Reggie?
The Reverend.
His great-uncle, his adoptive father. There was still a smile in his voice, but one tinged with nostalgia.
When we went to the monster films together of a Saturday, Iger and Rhaegar, and you should have seen the looks on the faces of the Ladies' Altar and Tea Society when Mrs. Graham let them in without announcing them, and they came into the Reverend's study to find us stamping around and roaring, kicking hell out of a Tokyo built of blocks and soup tins.
She laughed, but felt tears prick at the backs of her eyes. I wish I'd known the Reverend, she said, squeezing his hand.
I wish you had, too,
he said softly.
He would have liked you so much, Bree.
For the space of a few moments, while he talked, the dark forest and the flaming fire below had faded away. They were in Inverness, cosy in the Reverend's study, with rain on the windows, and the sound of traffic going by in the street. It happened so often when they talked like this, between themselves. Then some small thing would fracture the moment. Now it was a shout from the fire as people began to clap and sing, and the world of their own time vanished in an instant. What if he were gone? She thought suddenly. Could I bring it back, all by myself? A spasm of elemental panic gripped her, just for a moment, at the thought. Without Roger as her touchstone, with nothing but her own memories to serve as anchor to the future, that time would be lost, would fade into hazy dreams and be lost, leaving her no firm ground of reality to stand upon. She took a deep breath of the cold night air, crisp with wood smoke, and dug the balls of her feet hard into the ground as they walked, trying to feel solid.
Mama, mama, mama!
A small blob detached itself from the confusion round the fire and rocketed toward her, crashing into her knees with enough force to make her grab hold of Roger's arm.
Jem, there you are!
She scooped him up and buried her face in his hair, which smelled pleasantly of goats, hay, and spicy sausage. He was heavy and more than solid. Then Uta MacGillivray turned and saw them. Her broad face was creased in a frown, but broke into a beam of delight at seeing them. People turned at her call of greeting, and they were engulfed at once by the crowd, everyone asking questions, expressing gratified surprise at their coming. A few questions were asked about the Dutch family, but Kenny Lindsay had brought the news of the burning earlier. Brianna was glad of that. People clucked and shook their heads, but by now they had exhausted most of their horrified speculations and were turning to other matters. The cold of the graves beneath the fir trees still lingered as a faint chill on her heart. She had no wish to make that experience real again by talking about it. The newly engaged couple were seated together on a pair of upturned buckets, holding hands, faces blissful in the glow of the bonfire.
"I win," Brianna said, smiling at the sight of them. "Don't they look happy?"
"They do," Roger agreed. "I doubt Ronnie Sinclair is. Is he here?"
He glanced round, and so did she, but the Cooper was nowhere in sight.
"Wait! He's in his shop,"
she said, putting a hand on Roger's wrist and nodding toward the small building on the opposite side of the road. There were no windows on this side of the Cooper's shop, but a faint glow showed round the edge of the closed door. Roger glanced from the darkened shop to the convivial crowd round the fire. A good many of Uta's relations had ridden over with a lucky bridegroom, and his friends from Salem, bringing with them an immense barrel of black beer, which was adding to the festivities. The air was yeasty with the tang of hops. By contrast, the Cooper's shop had a desolate, glowering sort of air about it. She wondered whether anyone around the fire had yet missed Ronnie Sinclair.
I'll go and have a bit of a blether with him, eh?
Roger touched her back in brief affection.
He could maybe use a sympathetic ear.
That, and a stiff drink. She nodded toward the house, where Robin MacGillivray was visible through the open door, pouring what she assumed to be whiskey for a select circle of friends.
"I imagine he will have managed that for himself,"
Roger replied dryly. He left her, making his way around the convivial group by the fire. He disappeared in the dark, but then she saw the door of the cooper's shop open, and Roger silhouetted briefly against the glow from within, his tall form blocking the light before vanishing inside.
"Want a drink, Mama?"
Jimmy was wriggling like a tadpole, trying to get down. She set him on the ground, and he was off like a shot, nearly upsetting a stout lady with a platter of corn fritters. The aroma of the steaming fritters reminded her that she hadn't had any supper, and she made her way after Jemmy to the table of food, where Lizzie, in her role as almost daughter of the house, helped her importantly to sauerkraut, sausages, smoked eggs, and something involving corn and squash.
"Where's your sweetheart, Lizzie?" she asked, teasing. "Shouldn't you be spooning with him?"
"Oh, him."
Lizzie looked like someone recalling a thing of vague general interest but no immediate importance.
"Manfred, you mean? He's over there."
She squinted against the glow of the fire, then pointed with her serving spoon. Manfred MacGillivray, her own betrothed, was with three or four other young men, all with arms linked, swaying to and fro as they sang something in German. They appeared to have trouble remembering the words, as each verse dissolved into giggles and shoving accusations.
"Here, Schätzchen."
"That's sweetheart, Ken, in German,"
Lizzie explained, leaning down to give Jemmy a bite of sausage. He snapped the tidbit up like a starving seal and chewed industriously, then mumbled, "Wagrink," and wandered off into the night.
"Jem?"
Brianna made to go after him, but was hampered by an oncoming crowd headed for the table.
"Ah, dinna fash yourself about him," Lizzie assured her. "Everyone kens who he is. He'll come to nae harm."
She might still have gone after him, save that she saw a small blonde head pop up beside Jem's. Germaine, Jem's bosom friend. Germaine was 2 years older and had a great deal more worldly knowledge than the average 5-year-old, thanks in great part to his father's tutelage. She did hope he wasn't picking pockets in the crowd, and made a mental note to frisk him for contraband later. Germaine had Jem firmly by the hand, so she allowed herself to be persuaded to sit down with Lizzie, Inga, and Hilda on the bales of straw that had been placed a little way from the fire.
"Und wer ist your sweetheart, then?"
teased Hilda.
"Yon big bonny black devil?"
"Oh, hem,"
Brianna said, mimicking Lizzie, and they all broke into rather unladylike roars of laughter. Evidently the beer had been making the rounds for some time.
"He's comforting Ronnie," she said, with a nod toward the darkened cooper's shop. "Is your mother upset about Sanger's choice?"
"Ugh, aye," said Inga, rolling her eyes with great expressiveness. "Should have heard them at it, her and Sanger. Hammer and tongs, hammer and tongs. Da went out to the fishing and stayed a war 3 days."
Brianna ducked her head to hide a grin. Robin MacGillivray liked a peaceful life, something he was never likely to enjoy in the company of his wife and daughters.
"Oh, well," Hilda said philosophically, leaning back a little to ease the strain of her first pregnancy, which was well advanced.
"She couldn't really say so much, meine Mutter. Heinrich's her own cousin's son, after all, even if he is poor."
"But young," Inga added practically. "Da says Heinrich will have time to get rich."
Ronnie Sinclair wasn't precisely rich, and he was 30 years older than Sanger. On the other hand, he did own both his cooper's shop and half of the house in which he and the MacGillivrays lived, and Uta, having shepherded both her elder daughters to solid marriages with men of property, had obviously seen the advantages of a match between Sanger and Ronnie.
"I can see that it might be a little awkward," Brianna said tactfully. "Ronnie going on living with your family after..."
She nodded at the betrothed couple who were feeding each other bits of cake.
"Whew!" Hilda exclaimed, rolling her eyes. "I'm that glad not to be living here."
Inga nodded vigorous agreement, but added,
"Well, but Mutti isn't the one to be greeting over spilled milk. She's got an eye out for a wife for Ronnie. Just watch her."
She nodded toward the food table where Uto was chatting and smiling with a group of German women.
"Who do you think it is she has picked out?" Inga asked her sister, eyes narrowed as she watched her mother operate. "That wee Gretchen? Or your Archie's cousin, maybe? The wall-eyed one, Siona?"
Hilda, married to a Scot from Surrey County, shook her head at this.
"She'll want a German girl," she objected, "for she'll be thinking of what will happen if Ronnie dies and the wife marries again. If it's a German girl, chances are Mama can bully her into a new marriage with one of her nephews or cousins. Keep the property in the family, aye?"
Brianna listened with fascination as the girls discussed the situation with perfect matter-of-factness, and wondered whether Ronnie Sinclair had the slightest idea that his fate was being decided in this pragmatic fashion. But he'd been living with the MacGillivrays for more than a year, she reasoned. He must have some idea of Uta's methods. Thanking God silently that she was not herself compelled to live in the same house with the redoubtable Frau MacGillivray, she looked round for Lizzie, feeling a pang of sympathy for her erstwhile bondmaid. Lizzie would be living with Uta once her marriage to Manfred took place next year. Hearing the name Weems, she returned to the conversation at hand, only to discover that the girls weren't discussing Lizzie, but rather her father.
"Auntie Gertrude," declared Hilda,
and belched softly, fist to her mouth.
"She's a widow woman herself. She'd be the best for him."
"Auntie Gertrude would have poor wee Mr. Weems dead in a year," Inga objected, laughing. "She's twice his size. If she didn't kill him from exhaustion, she'd roll over in her sleep and squash him flat."
Hilda clapped both hands to her mouth, but less in shock than to stifle her giggles. Brianna thought she'd had her share of beer, too. Her cap was awry, and her pale face looked flushed, even by firelight.
"Eh, well, I think he's no much bothered at the thought. See him?"
Hilda nodded past the beer drinkers, and Brianna had no trouble picking out Mr. Weems's head, his hair pale and flyaway as his daughter's. He was in animated conversation with a stout woman in apron and cap, who nudged him intimately in the ribs, laughing. As she watched, though, Uta MacGillivray made her way toward them, followed by a tall blonde woman, who hesitated a little, hands folded under her apron.
"Oh, who's that?"
Inga craned her neck like a goose, and her sister elbowed her, scandalized.
"Lass das, du alte Zika. Mutti's looking this way."
Lizzie had half risen to her knees, peering.
"Hoo,"
she said, sounding like an owl. Her attention was momentarily distracted by Manfred, who dropped beside her in the straw, grinning amiably.
"How is it, then, Herzken?" he said,
putting an arm round her waist and trying to kiss her.
"Who's that, Freddy?"
she said, adroitly eluding his embrace and pointing discreetly toward the blonde woman, who was smiling shyly as Frau Uta introduced her to Mr. Weems. Manfred blinked, swaying a little on his knees, but answered readily enough.
"Oh, that's Fräulein Berisch, Pastor Berisch's sister."
Inga and Hilda made little cooing sounds of interest. Lizzie frowned a little, but then relaxed, seeing her father tilt back his head to address the newcomer. Fräulein Berisch was nearly as tall as Brianna herself.
"Well, that explains why she's still a Fräulein," Brianna thought with sympathy.
The woman's hair was streaked with grey where it showed beneath her cap, and she had a rather plain face, though her eyes held a calm sweetness.
"Oh, a Protestant, then," Lizzie said in a dismissive tone that made it clear that the Fraulein could hardly be considered as a potential mate for her father.
"Aye, but she's a nice woman for all that. Come and dance, Elizabeth."
Manfred had clearly lost any interest in Mr. Weems and the Fraulein. He pulled Lizzie, protesting, to her feet and propelled her toward the circle of dancers. She went reluctantly, but Brianna saw that by the time they had reached the dance, Lizzie was laughing at something Manfred had said, and he was smiling down at her, the firelight glowing on the handsome planes of his face. They were a nice-looking couple, she thought, better matched in appearance than Sanger and her Heinrich, who was tall but spindly and rather hatchet-faced. Inga and Hilda had begun arguing with each other in German, allowing Brianna to devote herself to the wholehearted consumption of the excellent supper. Hungry as she was, she would have enjoyed almost anything, but the tart, crisp sauerkraut and the sausages bursting with juice and spices were a rare treat. It was only as she wiped the last of the juice and grease from her wooden plate with a chunk of cornbread that she cast a glance at the cooper's shop, thinking guiltily that she ought perhaps to have saved some for Roger. He was so kind, taking thought for poor Ronnie's feelings. She felt a rush of pride and affection for him. Maybe she should go over there and rescue him. She had put down her plate and was sorting out her skirts and petticoats in preparation for putting this plan into action when she was forestalled by a pair of small figures who came weaving out of the darkness.
"Jem?" she said, startled. "What's the matter?"
The flames gleamed on Jemmy's hair like freshly minted copper, but the face under it was white, and his eyes enormous dark pools, fixed and staring.
"Jemmy?"
He turned a blank face to her, said, "Mama?" in a small, uncertain voice, then sat down suddenly, his legs collapsing under him like rubber bands. She was dimly aware of Germain swaying like a sapling in a high breeze, but had no attention to spare for him. She seized Jemmy, lifting his head and shaking him a little.
"Jemmy, wake up. What's wrong?"
"The wee laddie's dead drunken, Ian," said a voice above her, sounding amused. "Whatever have you been giving him?"
Robin McGillivray, rather obviously a little the worse for wear himself, leaned over and prodded Jemmy gently, eliciting nothing more than a soft gurgle. He picked up one of Jemmy's arms, then let it go. It fell, boneless as a strand of boiled spaghetti.
"I didn't give him anything," she replied, panic giving way to a rising annoyance, as she saw that Jemmy was, in fact, merely asleep, his small chest rising and falling with a reassuring rhythm.
"Germaine?"
Germaine had subsided into a small heap and was singing Alouette to himself in a dreamy sort of way. Brianna had taught it to him. It was his favourite song.
"Germaine, what did you give Jemmy to drink?"
"Je te plumerai la tête."
"Germaine!"
She grabbed him by the arm and he ceased singing, looking surprised to see her.
"What did you give Jemmy, Germaine?"
"He was thirsty, madame,"
Germaine said with a smile of surpassing sweetness.
"He wanted a drink."
Then his eyes rolled back in his head and he keeled over backward, limp as a dead fish.
"Oh, Jesus Christ on a piece of toast!"
Inga and Hilda looked shocked, but she was in no mood to worry about their sensibilities.
"Where the bloody hell is Massali?"
"She's no here," Inga said, bending forward to inspect Germaine. "She stopped at him with the wee maidkin. Fergus is..."
She straightened up, looking vaguely round.
"Well, I saw him a while ago. What's the trouble?"
The hoarse voice at her shoulder surprised her, and she turned to find Roger looking quizzical, his face relaxed from its usual sternness. "Your son is a drunkard," she informed him. Then she caught a whiff of Roger's breath. "Following in his father's footsteps, I see," she added coldly. Disregarding this, Roger sat down beside her and gathered Jemmy up into his lap. Holding the little boy propped against his knee, he patted Jemmy's cheek, gently but insistently.
"Hello there, Midge," he said softly. "Hello then. You're all right, are you?"
Like magic, Jemmy's eyelids floated up. He smiled dreamily at Roger.
"Hello, Daddy."
Still smiling beatifically, his eyes closed, and he relaxed into utter limpness, cheek flattened against his father's knee.
"He's all right," Roger told her.
"Well, good," she said, not particularly mollified. "What do you think they've been drinking? Beer?" Roger leaned forward and sniffed at his offspring's red-stained lips.
"Cherry bouncer, to guess. There's a vat of it round by the barn."
"Holy God!" She'd never drunk cherry bounce, but Mrs. Bug had told her how to make it.
"Tak the juice of a bushel of cherries, dissolve 24 pounds of sugar over it, and then you put it into a 40-gallon cask and fill it up with whiskey."
"He's all right," Roger patted her arm.
"Is that your mane over there?"
"It is." She leaned over to check, but Jermaine was peacefully asleep, also smiling.
"That cherry bounce must be good stuff."
Roger laughed.
"It's terrible. Like industrial-strength cough syrup. I will say it makes you very cheerful, though."
"Have you been drinking it?" She eyed him narrowly, but his lips appeared to be their usual colour.
"Of course not."
He leaned over and kissed her to prove it.
"Surely you didn't think a Scotsman like Ronnie would deal with disappointment by drinking cherry bounce, when there's decent whiskey to hand."
"True," she said. She glanced at the cooperage. The faint glow from the hearth fire had faded, and the outline of the door had disappeared, leaving the building no more than a faint rectangle of black against the darker mass of the forest beyond. "How is Ronnie dealing with it?" She glanced round, but Inga and Hilda had taken themselves off to help Frau Ute. All of them were clustered round the food table, clearing things away.
"Oh, he's all right, Ronnie."
Roger moved Jemmy off his lap, placing him gently on his side in the straw near Jermaine.
"He wasn't in love with Senga, after all. He's suffering from sexual frustration, not a broken heart."
"Oh, well, if that's all," she said dryly, "he won't have to suffer much longer. I'm informed that Frau Ute has the matter well in hand."
"Aye, she's told him she'll find him a wife. He's what you might call philosophical about the matter, though still reeking with lust," he added, wrinkling his nose.
"Ew.
Do you want anything to eat?" She glanced at the little boys, getting her feet under her. "I better get you something before Ute and the girls clear it all away." Roger yawned, suddenly and immensely.
"No, I'm all right."
He blinked, smiling sleepily at her.
"I'll go tell Fergus where Jermaine is. Maybe snatch a bite on the way."
He patted her shoulder, then stood up, swaying only a little, and moved off toward the fire. She checked the boys again. Both were breathing deeply and regularly, dead to the world. With a sigh, she bundled them close together, piling up the straw around them, and covered them with her cloak. It was growing colder, but winter had gone. There was no feel of frost in the air. The party was still going on, but it had shifted to a lower gear. The dancing had stopped, and the crowd broken up into smaller groups. Men gathered in a circle near the fire, lighting their pipes. The younger men disappeared somewhere. All around her, families were settling in for the night, making nests for themselves in the hay. Some were in the house, more in the barn. She could hear the sound of a guitar from somewhere behind the house, and a single voice singing something slow and wistful. It made her yearn suddenly for the sound of Roger's voice as it had been, rich and tender. Thinking of that, though, she realized something. His voice had been much better when he came back from consoling Ronnie. Still husky and with only a shadow of its former resonance, but it had come easily without that choked note in it. Perhaps alcohol relaxed the vocal cords? More likely, she thought, it simply relaxed Roger, removing some of his inhibitions about the way he sounded. That was worth knowing. Her mother had opined that his voice would improve if he would stretch it, work with it, but he was shy of using it, wary of pain, whether from the actual sensation of speaking or from the contrast with the way he had sounded before. "So, maybe I'll make a little cherry bounce," she said aloud. Then she looked at the two small forms slumbering in the hay and contemplated the prospect of waking up alongside three hangovers come morning. Well, maybe not. She bunched up enough hay for a pillow, spread her folded kerchief over it. They'd be picking hay out of their clothes most of tomorrow, and lay down, curling her body round Jem's. If either boy stirred or vomited in his sleep, she'd feel it and rouse. The bonfire had burned down. Only a ragged fringe of flames now flickered over the bed of glowing embers, and the lanterns set around the yard had all gone out, or been thriftily extinguished. Guitar and singer had ceased. Without light and noise to keep it at bay, the night came in, spreading wings of cold silence over the mountain. The stars burned bright above, but they were pinpricks, millennia away. She closed her eyes against the immensity of the night, bowing to put her lips against Jem's head, cradling his warmth. She tried to compose her mind for sleep, but without the distractions of company and with the scent of burning timber strong in the air. Memory stole back, and her normal prayers of blessing became pleas for mercy and protection. "He hath put my brethren far from me, and mine acquaintance are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me." "I won't forget you," she said silently to the dead. It seemed so pitiful a thing to say, so small and futile, and yet the only thing in her power. She shivered briefly, tightening her grip on Jemmy. A sudden rustle of the hay, and Roger slid in behind her. He fumbled a bit, spreading his own cloak over her, then sighed with relief, his body relaxing heavily against hers as his arm came round her waist.
"Been a bloody long day, hasn't it?"
She groaned faintly in agreement. Now that everything was quiet, with no more need to talk, watch, pay attention, every fibre of her muscles seemed about to dissolve with fatigue. There was no more than a thin layer of hay between her and cold, hard ground, but she felt sleep lapping at her like the waves of the tide creeping up a sandy shore, soothing and inexorable. "Did you get something to eat?" She put a hand on his leg, and his arm tightened in reflex, holding her close.
"Aye, if you think beer's food. Many folk do."
He laughed, a warm fog of hops on his breath.
"I'm fine."
The warmth of his body was beginning to seep through the layers of cloth between them, dispelling the night's chill. Jem always gave off heat when he slept. It was like holding a clay firepot with him curled against her. Roger was putting out even more heat, though. Well, her mother did say that an alcohol lamp burned hotter than oil. She sighed and snuggled back against him, feeling warm, protected. The cold immensity of the night had lifted now that she had her family close, together again, and safe. Roger was humming. She realized it quite suddenly. There was no tune to it, but she felt the vibration of his chest against her back. She didn't want to chance stopping him. Surely that was good for his vocal cords. He stopped on his own, though, after a moment. Hoping to start him again, she reached back to stroke his leg, essaying a small questioning hum of her own.
Hmm? Hmm?
His hands cupped her buttocks and fastened tight.
Mm-hmm,
he said, in what sounded like a combination of invitation and satisfaction. She didn't reply, but made a slight dissentient motion of the behind. Under normal conditions, this would have caused him to let go. He did let go, but only with one hand, and this in order to slide it down her leg, evidently meaning to get hold of her skirt and ruckle it up. She reached back hastily and grabbed the roving hand, bringing it round and placing it on her breast, as an indication that while she appreciated the notion, and under other circumstances would be thrilled to oblige, just this moment, she thought. Roger was usually very good at reading her body language, but evidently this skill had dissolved in whiskey. That, or the thought came suddenly to her, he simply didn't care whether she wanted... Roger! She hissed. He had started humming again, the sound now interspersed with the low, bumping noises a tea kettle makes just before the boil. He got his hand down her leg and up her skirt, hot on the flesh of her thigh, groping swiftly upward and inward. Jemmy coughed, jerking in her arms, and she made an attempt to kick Roger in the shin as a signal of discouragement.
"Good. You're beautiful,"
he murmured into the curve of her neck.
"Oh, God, so beautiful, so beautiful, so..."
The next words were a mumble against her skin, but she thought he'd said slippery. His fingers had reached their goal, and she arched her back, trying to squirm away.
"Roger," she said, keeping her voice low. "Roger! There are people around."
And a snoring toddler wedged like a doorstop in front of her. He mumbled something in which the words "dark" and "nobody'll see" were distinguishable. And then the groping hand retreated, only to grab a handful of her skirts and start shoving them out of the way. He had resumed the humming, pausing momentarily to murmur,
love you so much."
"I love you too," she said, reaching back and trying to catch his hand. "Roger, stop that." He did, but immediately reached around her and grasped her by the shoulder. A quick heave, and she was lying on her back, staring up at the distant stars, which were at once blotted out by Roger's head and shoulders as he rolled on top of her in a tremendous rustling of hay and loosened clothing.
"Jem!"
She flung out a hand toward Jemmy, who appeared not to have been disturbed by the sudden disappearance of his backstop, but was still curled up in the hay like a hibernating hedgehog. Roger was, of all things, singing now, if one could call it that. Or chanting, at least, the words to a very bawdy Scottish song, about a miller who is pestered by a young woman wanting him to grind her corn. Whereupon he does.
"He flung her down upon the sacks, and there she got her corn ground, her corn ground."
Roger was chanting hotly in her ear, his full weight pinning her to the ground and the stars spinning madly far above. She'd thought his description of Ronnie as reeking with lust merely a figure of speech, but evidently not. Bare flesh met bare flesh, and then some. She gasped. So did Roger.
"Oh, God," he said.
He paused, frozen for an instant against the sky above her, then sighed in an ecstasy of whiskey fumes and began to move with her, humming.
It was dark, thank God, though not nearly dark enough.
The remnants of the fire cast an eerie glow over his face, and he looked for an instant the bonny big black devil Inga had called him. "Lie back and enjoy it," she thought. The hay made a tremendous rustling, but there were other rustlings nearby, and the sound of the wind soughing through the trees in the cove was nearly enough to drown them all in sibilance. She had managed to suppress her embarrassment, and was indeed beginning to enjoy it, when Roger got his hands under her, lifting.
"Wrap your legs round me," he whispered, and nipped her earlobe with his teeth. "Wrap them round my back and hammer my ass with your heels."
Moved partly by an answering wantonness and partly by a desire to squeeze the breath out of him like an accordion, she flung her legs apart and swung them high, scissoring them tight across his heaving back. He gave an ecstatic groan and redoubled his efforts. Wantonness was winning. She had nearly forgotten where they were. Hanging on for dear life and thrilled by the ride, she arched her back and jerked, shuddering against the heat of him, the night wind's touch cool and electric on thighs and buttocks bared to the dark. Trembling and moaning, she melted back against the hay, her legs still locked around his hips. Boneless and nerveless, she let her head roll to the side and slowly, languidly, opened her eyes. Someone was there. She saw movement in the dark and froze. It was Fergus, come to fetch his son. She heard the murmur of his voice speaking French to Germaine and the quiet rustle of his footsteps in the hay, moving off. She lay still, heart pounding, legs still locked in place. Roger, meanwhile, had reached his own quietus. Head hanging so that his long hair brushed her face like cobwebs in the dark, he murmured, "Love you. God, I love you." And lowered himself slowly and gently. Whereupon he breathed, "Thank you," in her ear, and lapsed into warm half-consciousness on top of her, breathing heavily. "Oh," she said, looking up to the peaceful stars, "don't mention it." She unlocked her stiff legs and with some difficulty got herself and Roger disentangled, more or less covered, and restored to blessed anonymity in their hay-lined nest, Jemmy safely stowed between them. "Hey," she said suddenly, and Roger stirred. "Hmm? What sort of monster was Iger?" He laughed, and the sound was low and clear. "Oh, Iger was a giant sponge cake with chocolate icing. He'd fall on the other monsters and smother them with sweetness." He laughed again, hiccuped, and subsided in the hay. "Roger," she said softly a moment later. There was no answer, and she stretched a hand across the slumbering body of her son to rest light on Roger's arm. "Sing to me," she whispered, though she knew that he already was asleep. Chapter 7. James Fraser, Indian Agent. "James Fraser, Indian Agent," I said, closing one eye as though reading it off a screen. "It sounds like a Wild West television show." Jamie paused in the act of pulling off his stockings and eyed me warily.
"That does. Is that good?"
"Insofar as the hero of a television show never dies, yes."
"In that case, I'm in favour of it," he said, examining the stocking he just pulled off.
He sniffed it suspiciously, rubbed a thumb over a thin patch on the heel, shook his head, and tossed it into the laundry basket.
"Must I sing?"
"Sing? Oh," I said, recollecting that the last time I had tried to explain television to him, my descriptions had focused largely on the Ed Sullivan show. "No, I don't think so.
Nor yet swing from a trapeze."
"Well, that's a comfort. I'm none so young as I was, Ken."
He stood up and stretched himself, groaning. The house had been built with 8-foot ceilings to accommodate him, but his fists brushed the pine beams even so.
"Christ, but it's been a long day."
"Well, it's nearly over," I said, sniffing in turn at the bodice of the gown I just shed. It smelt strongly, though not disagreeably, of horse and wood smoke. "Air it a bit," I decided, "and see whether it could go another little while without washing. I couldn't have swung on a trapeze even when I was young."
"I'd pay money to see you try," he said, grinning.
"What is an Indian agent?" I inquired.
"MacDonald seemed to think he was doing you a signal favour by suggesting you for the job."
He shrugged, unbuckling his kilt.
"No doubt he thinks he is."
He shook the garment experimentally, and a fine sifting of dust and horsehair bloomed on the floor beneath it. He went to the window, opened the shutters, and thrusting the kilt outside, shook it harder.
"He would be,"
his voice came faintly from the night outside, then more strongly as he turned round again.
"Were it not for this war of yours."
"Of mine?" I said, indignant. "You sound as though you think I'm proposing to start it single-handed." He made a small gesture of dismissal.
"You ken what I mean. An Indian agent, Sasanach, is what it sounds like. A fellow who goes out and parleys with the local Indians, giving them gifts and talking them round in hopes that they'll be inclined to ally themselves with the Crown's interests, whatever those may happen to be."
"Oh? And what's this Southern Department that MacDonald mentioned?" I glanced involuntarily toward the closed door of our room, but muffled snoring from across the hall indicated that our guest had already collapsed into the arms of Morpheus.
"Mm-hmm. There's a Southern Department and a Northern Department that deal with Indian affairs in the colonies. The Southern Department is under John Stewart, who's an Inverness man."
"Turn round. I'll do it."
I turned my back gratefully to him. With expertise born of long experience, he had the lacing of my stays undone in seconds. I sighed deeply as they loosened and fell. He plucked the shift away from my body, massaging my ribs where the boning had pressed the damp fabric into my skin.
"Thank you."
I sighed in bliss and leaned back against him.
"And being an Inverness man, MacDonald thinks this Stewart will have a natural predisposition to employ other Highlanders?"
"That might depend upon whether Stewart's ever met any of my kin," Jamie said dryly. "But MacDonald thinks so, aye."
He kissed the top of my head in absent affection, then withdrew his hands and began untying the lace that bound his hair.
"Sit," I said, stepping out of my fallen stays. "I'll do it."
He sat on the stool in his shirt, closing his eyes in momentary relaxation as I unbraided his hair. He'd worn it, clubbed in a tight queue for riding, bound up for the last 3 days. I ran my hands up into the warm, fiery mass as it unravelled from its plait, and the loosened waves of it spilled cinnamon and gold and silver in the firelight as I rubbed the pads of my fingers gently into his scalp.
"Gifts, you said? Does the Crown supply these gifts?"
The Crown, I had noticed, had a bad habit of honouring men of substance with offices that required them to come up with large amounts of their own money.
"Theoretically."
He yawned hugely, broad shoulders slumping comfortably as I took up my hairbrush and set about tidying him.
"Oh, that's nice. That's why MacDonald thinks it a favour. There's the possibility of doing well in trade.
Besides, generally excellent opportunities for corruption."
"Yes, I see."
I worked for a few minutes before asking, "Will you do it?"
"I dinna ken. I must think a bit." "You were mentioning Wild West. Brian has said such a thing, telling me about cowherds."
"Cowboys." He waved off the correction.
"And the Indians." "That's true, is it? What she says about the Indians?"
"If what she says is that they'll be largely exterminated over the next century or so, yes, she's right." I smoothed his hair, then sat down on the bed facing him and set about brushing my own. "Does that trouble you?" His brows drew together a little as he considered it, and he scratched absently at his chest, where the curly red-gold hair showed at the open neck of his shirt.
"No," he said slowly. "Not precisely. It's not as though I should be doing them to death with my own hands. But we're coming to it, are we not? The time when I must tread with some care if I'm to walk betwixt the fires."
I'm afraid we are, I said, an uneasy tightness hovering between my shoulder blades. I saw what he meant all too clearly. The battle lines were not clear yet, but they were being drawn. To become an Indian agent for the Crown was to appear to be a loyalist, all very well for the moment, when the rebel movement was no more than a radical fringe with pockets of disaffection. But very, very dangerous, as we grew closer to the point where the disaffected seized power and independence was declared. Knowing the eventual outcome, Jamie dare not wait too long to ally himself to the rebel side, but to do so too early was to risk arrest for treason. Not a good prospect for a man who was already a pardoned traitor. Of course, I said diffidently, if you were to be an Indian agent, I suppose you might actually persuade some of the Indian tribes into supporting the American side, or staying neutral at least.
I might, he agreed, with a certain note of bleakness in his voice. But putting aside any question as to the honour of such a course, that would help condemn them, no? Would the same thing happen to them in the end, you think, if the English were to win?
They won't, I said, with a slight edge. He glanced sharply at me.
I do believe you, he said, with a similar edge. I've reason to, I.
I nodded, my lips pressed together. I didn't want to talk about the earlier rising. I didn't want to talk about the oncoming revolution either, but there was little choice about that. I don't know, I said, and took a deep breath. No one can say, since it didn't happen. But if I were to guess, then I think the Indians might quite possibly do better under British rule. I smiled at him a little ruefully. Believe it or not, the British Empire did, or will, I should say, generally manage to run its colonies without entirely exterminating the native people in them.
Bar the Heelan folk, he said, very dryly. Aye, I'll take your word for it, Sasnach.
He stood up, running a hand back through his hair, and I caught a glimpse of the tiny streak of white that ran through it, legacy of a bullet wound. You should talk to Roger about it, I said. He knows a great deal more than I do. He nodded, but didn't reply, beyond a faint grimace. Where do you suppose Roger and Bree went, speaking of Roger?
To the McGillivrays, I suppose, he replied, surprised. To fetch wee Jem.
How do you know that? I asked, equally surprised.
When there's mischief afoot, a man wants his family safe under his eye, Ken.
He raised one brow at me, and reaching to the top of the wardrobe, took down his sword. He drew it halfway from its scabbard, then put it back and set the scabbard gently back in place, the sword loosened, hilt ready to hand. He'd brought a loaded pistol upstairs with him. That was placed on the washstand by the window. The rifle and fowling piece, too, had been left loaded and primed, hanging from their hooks above the hearth downstairs. And with a small ironic flourish, he drew the dirk from its belt sheath and slid it neatly under our pillow. Sometimes I forget, I said, a little wistfully, watching this. There had been a dirk under the pillow of our wedding couch, and under many a one since then.
Do you?
He smiled at that, a little lopsidedly, but he smiled. Don't you, ever? He shook his head, still smiling, though it had a rueful tinge.
Sometimes I wish I did.
This colloquy was interrupted by a spluttering snort across the hall, followed at once by a thrashing of bedclothes, violent oaths, and a sharp thump, as something, likely a shoe, struck the wall.
Fucking cat!
Bellowed Major MacDonald. I sat, hand pressed across my mouth, as the stomp of bare feet vibrated through the floorboards, succeeded briefly by the crash of the Major's door, which flung open, then shut with a bang. Jamie, too, had stood frozen for an instant. Now he moved, very delicately, and soundlessly eased our own door open. Adso, tail arrogantly S-shaped, strolled in. Magnificently ignoring us, he crossed the room, leapt lightly onto the washstand, and sat in the basin, where he stuck a back leg into the air and began calmly licking his testicles.
"I saw a man once in Paris who could do that," Jamie remarked, observing this performance with interest.
"Are there people willing to pay to watch such things?" I assumed that no one was likely to engage in a public exhibition of that sort merely for the fun of it. Not in Paris, anyway.
Well, it wasn't the man so much. More his female companion, who was likewise flexible.
He grinned at me, his eyes glinting blue in the candlelight.
Like watching worms, mate, aye?
How fascinating, I murmured. I glanced at the washstand where Adso was now doing something even more indelicate. You're lucky the Major doesn't sleep armed, cat. He might have potted you like a jugged hare.
Oh, I doubt that. Our Donald likely sleeps with a blade, but he kens well enough which side of his bread's buttered. You wouldn't be likely to give him breakfast and he'd skewered your cat.
I glanced toward the door. The mattress heaving and muttered curses across the hall had died down. The Major, with the practiced ease of a professional soldier, was already well on his way back to dreamland. I suppose not. You were right about his worming his way into a position with the new governor, which is the real reason for his desire for your political advancement, I imagine. Jamie nodded, but had plainly lost interest in discussing MacDonald's machinations.
I was right, no? That means you owe me a forfeit, Sassenach.
He eyed me with an air of dawning speculation, which I hoped had not been too much inspired by his memories of the worm-like Parisians. Oh? I regarded him warily. And, what, precisely?
Well, I haven't quite worked out all the details as yet. But to think you should maybe lie on the bed to begin with.
That sounded like a reasonable start to the matter. I piled up the pillows at the head of the bed, pausing to remove the dirk, then began to climb onto it. I paused again, though, and instead bent to wind the bed key, tightening the ropes that supported the mattress, until the bedstead groaned and the ropes gave a creaking twang.
Very canny, Sassenach. Jamie said behind me, sounding amused.
Experience, I informed him, clambering over the newly tautened bed on hands and knees. I've waked up often enough after a night with you, with a mattress folded up round my ears, and my arse no more than an inch off the ground.
Oh, I expect your arse will end up somewhat higher than that, he assured me.
Oh, you're going to let me be on top? I had mixed feelings about that. I was desperately tired, and while I enjoyed riding Jamie all right, I'd been riding a beastly horse for more than 10 hours, and the thigh muscles required for both activities were trembling spasmodically.
Perhaps later, he said, eyes narrowed in thought. Lie back, Sassenach, and ruckle up your shift. Then open your legs for me. There's a good lass, no? A bit wider, aye?
He began, with deliberate slowness, to remove his shirt. I sighed and shifted my buttocks a little, looking for a position that wouldn't give me cramp if I had to hold it for long. If you have in mind what I think you have in mind, you'll regret it. I haven't even bathed properly, I said reproachfully. I'm desperately filthy, and I smell like a horse. Naked, he raised one arm and sniffed appraisingly.
Oh, well, so do I. That's no matter. I'm fond of horses.
He'd abandoned any pretense of delay, but paused to survey his arrangements, looking me over with approval.
Aye, very good. Now then, if you'll just put your hands above your head and seize the bedstead.
You wouldn't, I said, and then lowered my voice with an involuntary glance toward the door. Not with MacDonald just across the hall?
Oh, I would, he assured me. And the devil wee MacDonald and a dozen more like him.
He paused, though, studying me thoughtfully, and after a moment sighed and shook his head.
No, he said quietly. Not tonight. You're still thinking of that poor Dutch bastard and his family, no?
Yes. Aren't you? He sat down beside me on the bed with a sigh.
I've been trying very hard not to, he said frankly. But the new dead didn't lie easy in their graves, do they?
I laid a hand on his arm, relieved that he felt the same. The night air seemed restless with the passage of spirits, and I had felt the dragging melancholy of that desolate garden, that row of graves, all through the events and alarums of the evening.
It was a night to be securely locked inside, with a good fire on the hearth and people nearby.
The house stirred, shutters creaking in the wind.
I do want you, Claire, Jamie said softly. I need, if you will.
And had they spent the night before their deaths like this, I wondered? Peaceful and snug betwixt their walls, husband and wife whispering together, lying close in their bed, having no notion what the future held. I saw in memory her long white thighs as the wind blew over her, and the glimpse I'd had of the small curly mat between them, the pudenda beneath its nimbus of brown hair, pale as carved marble, the seam of it sealed like a virgin statue.
I need to, I said, just as softly.
Come here. He leaned close and pulled the drawstring neatly from the neck of my shift, so the worn linen wilted off my shoulders. I made a grab for the fabric, but he caught my hand and held it down by my side. One-fingered, he brushed the shift lower, then put out the candle, and in a dark that smelled of wax and honey and the sweat of horses, kissed my forehead, eyes, the corners of my cheeks, my lips and chin, and so continued, slow and soft-lipped, to the arches of my feet. He raised himself then, and suckled my breasts for a long time, and I ran my hand up his back and cupped his buttocks, naked and vulnerable in the dark. Afterward, we lay in a pleasantly vermiform tangle, the only light in the room a faint glow from the banked hearth. I was so tired that I could feel my body sinking into the mattress, and desired nothing more than to keep going down, down, into the welcoming dark of oblivion.
Sassenach?
Hmm? A moment's hesitation, then his hand found mine, curling round it.
You wouldn't do what she did, would you?
Who?
Her. The Dutch woman.
Snatched back from the edge of sleep, I was muzzy and confused, sufficiently so that even the image of the dead woman, shrouded in her apron, seemed unreal, no more disturbing than the random fragments of reality my brain tossed overboard in a vain effort to keep afloat as I sank down into the depths of sleep.
What?
Fall into the fire? I'll try not to, I assured him, yawning.
Good night.
No. Wake up.
He shook my arm gently.
Talk to me, Sassenach.
It was a considerable effort, but I pushed away the enticing arms of Morpheus and flounced over onto my side, facing him.
Talk to you. About the Dutch woman, he repeated patiently. If I were to be killed, you wouldn't go and kill your whole family, would you?
What? I rubbed my free hand over my face, trying to make some sense of this amid the drifting shreds of sleep.
Whose whole... Oh!
You think she did it on purpose? Poisoned them?
I think maybe so.
His words were no more than a whisper, but they brought me back to full consciousness. I lay silent for a moment, then reached out, wanting to be sure he was really there. He was. a large, solid object, the smooth bone of his hip warm and live under my hand.
"It might as well have been an accident," I said, voice pitched low. "You can't know for sure."
"No," he admitted, "but I cannot keep from seeing it."
He turned restlessly onto his back.
"The men came," he said softly, to the beams overhead. "He fought them, and they killed him there, on his own threshold. And when she saw her man was gone, I think she told the men she must feed the wains first, before. And then she put toadstools into the stew and fed it to the bairns and her mother. She took the two men with them, but I think it was that that was the accident. She only meant to follow him. She wouldn't leave him there, alone."
I wanted to tell him that this was a rather dramatic interpretation of what we had seen, but I couldn't very well tell him he was wrong. Hearing him describe what he saw in thought, I saw it too, all too clearly.
"You don't know," I said at last, softly. "You can't know."
"Unless you find the other men," I thought suddenly, "and ask them."
I didn't say that, though. Neither of us spoke for a bit. I could tell that he was still thinking, but the quicksand of sleep was once more pulling me down, clinging and seductive.
"What if I canna keep you safe?"
he murmured at last. His head moved suddenly on the pillow, turning toward me.
"You and the rest of them."
"I shall try with all my strength, Sassenach, and I dinna mind if I die doing it.
But what if I should die too soon and fail?"
And what answer was there to that?
"You won't," I whispered back.
He sighed and bent his head so his forehead rested against mine. I could smell eggs and whiskey warm on his breath.
"I'll try not," he said.
And I put my mouth on his, soft against mine, acknowledgement and comfort in the dark. I laid my head against the curve of his shoulder, wrapped a hand round his arm, and breathed in the smell of his skin, smoke and salt, as though he had been cured in the fire.
"You smell like a smoked ham," I murmured,
and he made a low sound of amusement and wedged his hand into its accustomed spot, clasped between my thighs. I let go then, at last, and let the heavy sands of sleep engulf me. Perhaps he said it as I fell into darkness, or perhaps I only dreamed it.
"If I die," he whispered in the dark, "dinna follow me. The bairns will need you. Stay for them. I can wait."
Part 2. A Gathering of Shadows. Chapter 8. Victim of a Massacre.
From Lord John Grey to Mr. James Fraser, Esquire. April 14th, 1773. My dear friend, I write you in good health and trust that I find you and yours in similar condition. My son has returned to England, there to complete his education. He writes with delight of his experiences. I enclose a copy of his most recent letter, and assures me of his well-being. More importantly, my mother also writes to assure me that he flourishes, though I believe, more from what she does not say than from what she does, that he introduces an unaccustomed element of confusion and upheaval in her household. I confess to feeling the lack of this element in my own household. So orderly and well-regulated a life as mine is these days, you would be astonished. Still, the quiet seems oppressive to me, and while I am in health in terms of body, I find my spirit somewhat flagging. I miss William sadly, I fear. For distraction from my solitary state, I have of late undertaken a new employment, that of making wine. While I admit the product lacks the power of your own distillations, I flatter myself that it is not undrinkable, and, if allowed to stand for a year or two, might eventually be palatable. I shall send you a dozen bottles later in the month by the hand of my new servant, Mr. Higgins, whose history you may find interesting. You will perhaps have heard something of a disreputable brawl occurring in Boston in March of 3 years past, which I've often seen in newspaper and broadside, called a massacre, most irresponsibly, and most inaccurately to one who has been privy to the actual occurrence. I was not present myself, but have spoken to numerous of the officers and soldiers who were. If they speak truly, and I believe they do, such a view as is given by the Boston press of the matter has been monstrous. Boston is, by all accounts, a perfect hellhole of Republican sentiment, with so-called marching societies at large in the streets in every weather, these being no more than an excuse for the assembly of mobs, whose chief sport is the tormenting of the troops quartered there. Higgins tells me that no man would dare go out